Welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federal Society's Litigation Practice Group, was recorded on Thursday, July 9th, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federal Society members.
Well, good afternoon, everyone, and welcome to the Federal Society's Practice Group telephone conference call on the future of arbitration agreements after the CFPB study. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform and Consumer Protection Act of 2010 instructs the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau to study the use of agreements providing for arbitration of any future dispute in connection with the offering of providing of consumer financial products or services, and then provide a report to Congress on the same topic. This past March, the CFPB issued its study pursuant to the statutory requirement. And one of the big questions that we're going to investigate today or discuss is if the arbitration study is actually an anti-arbitration study. And we've got two experts to discuss the topic with us today. As always, please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call, and also that this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. Today, our two experts are Mr. Deepak Gupta, who is the founding principal of Gupta Wessler PLLC, and then Mr. Andrew J. Pincus, who is a partner at Mayer Brown LLP. More complete bios of our speakers were provided to you in notice of the call, so I will stop there and reserve more time for their discussion, followed by your questions. So I think first we're going to hear from Mr. Gupta, so the floor is yours.
Great. Well, thank you, and thanks to the Federalist Society for inviting me to come talk about this topic. It's a topic that's near and dear to my heart, and I can't think of anyone better to talk about this with than Andy Pincus. Andy and I faced off in the AT&T versus Concepcion case in the Supreme Court on the enforceability of class action bans in arbitration clauses, and we've both continued to be very actively involved on this issue. And I was actually at the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau at its launch, so I am a fan and supporter of the agency. And I guess, you know, to the extent we'll be answering the question you posed, I'll be defending the CFPB, and perhaps Andy will have some more critical things to say about it. But it's always great to talk to Andy about these issues. So to set the stage, I think, you know, the way you described the statutory authority that the CFPB has is accurate. The Dodd-Frank Wall Street Reform Act gives the CFPB very broad authority. Congress really kind of went out of its way to place very few limits on this authority. Other than the requirement that the Bureau conduct a study of the use of arbitration clauses in consumer disputes. Once that study is conducted, the Bureau then, and here's the statute, it's section 1028 of the Dodd-Frank Act, quote, may prohibit or impose conditions or limitations on the use of an agreement for arbitration. And the Bureau can do that so long as the Bureau finds that it's, quote, in the public interest and for the protection of consumers. And then the findings in the rule have to be consistent with the study. So that's a whole lot of leeway that the Bureau has been given to regulate in this space. And it doesn't come on a blank slate. It comes against the backdrop of the financial crisis. It comes against the backdrop of increasing controversy about this issue in the courts. What once was an issue, the Federal Arbitration Act, on which there was consensus, has increasingly been one on which there have been very hotly contested 5-4 decisions in the Supreme Court, including the Concepcion case and American Express versus Italian Colors. And it's also become an increasingly contentious policy issue. And Congress has acted before. So back in 2006, Congress passed a bill called the Military Lending Act that was based on concerns that arbitration in fringe lending products to military service members were actually causing a national security risk. And part of the problem was the lack of accountability for those products and services. And so Congress introduced a ban on arbitration in that very narrow context, certain financial products to military service members. And then again, when the Dodd-Frank Act was passed, Congress banned the use of mandatory arbitration clauses in mortgage contracts in the wake of the mortgage crisis, I think based on a recognition that more judicial accountability of what the mortgage industry was up to would have been better rather than less. And so I think it's important to understand the Bureau's authority against that backdrop, that Congress was really focused on this. They had effected some limited bans. And rather than effect a ban across the entire consumer financial services marketplace, which Congress could have done, it instead said, let's use this new agency to undertake an empirical analysis of the problem. And that's precisely what the Bureau has done. Whatever else you want to say about this study, it is the single most comprehensive empirical analysis of the use of arbitration in the consumer context ever conducted, and then some. It's an incredibly comprehensive study. It's over 800 pages long. It covers every conceivable topic from the level of understanding and consent that consumers have when they enter into these contracts to what the outcomes are in individual arbitration versus the outcomes in the class action system. So some of the critiques of the Bureau's first preliminary results, I think, haven't been borne out. There were critiques that the Bureau wasn't going to study comparative effects in the civil justice system. That's actually happened now. The results are pretty, in my view, pretty hard to argue with. The Bureau is not saying what it will do. It's not telegraphing a particular policy result. But when you read the study, it's hard not to come away with the impression that there are some serious problems that need to be regulated. For one thing, the Bureau finds that only about 7% of the people surveyed even know that these clauses are there or understand them. And then when you look at what actually happens, so the Bureau was able to get data from the American Arbitration Association, which is the principal, the largest provider of consumer arbitration, I think the most reputable. They opened their files to the Bureau, and so we have data that we didn't have before. And the Bureau looked in particular at disputes in 2010 and 2011. And one statistic that really jumps out to me, and I think is directly responsive to the argument made by proponents of arbitration that arbitration is better, cheaper, and faster. It's a better way of delivering compensation in some people's views to consumers. So let's look at what consumers actually receive. And the most relevant universe to look at would be small claims, because these are the claims that absent arbitration clauses and class action bans would be able to be aggregated by consumers, right? The principal economic justification for the class action device is, as Judge Posner said, only a lunatic or a fanatic sues for $30, and so it's going to be a class action or nothing. So let's look at how many cases consumers brought where they had an affirmative claim for $1,000 or less. And let's look at how many consumers actually brought such disputes and how many got something out of it. And what they find is that across all of the markets regulated by the CFPB, in the AAA in those years, that there were about 25 disputes a year where consumers made affirmative claims of $1,000 or less. That is an exceedingly small number. And so it shows that it's no answer to say, well, of the tens of millions of claims that could be aggregated in the class action, they can just go to arbitration, and that's a meaningful, realistic alternative as a matter of economics. And then when you look at how many people actually got relief, the number is not 4,000 people, not 400 people, not 40 people, but 4 people. There are 4 consumers that were granted affirmative relief by arbitrators who had affirmative claims of $1,000 or less in 2010 and 2011. And I think if there's one statistic from these 800 pages that people should come away from as responsive to this debate, it's that one, because I think it completely belies the notion that arbitration is, at least from a compensation perspective, providing any effective alternative. The Bureau doesn't stop there, though. It also attempts to show what the flip side is. It shows that tens of millions, by contrast, tens of millions of consumers were eligible for monetary relief under class actions in the same period, about $540 million per year, and over a five-year period studied about $2 billion in cash relief. And to address the concern that some folks have about claims rates in class actions, the Bureau looks specifically at cases, you know, many, the Bureau, of course, regulates banks, right? So they look at cases involving banks where millions of dollars in relief is deposited directly in the consumer's account. And there's a great case study in the report looking at the overdraft class actions where you had all of this cash relief delivered to consumers in their accounts, and you also had behavioral relief, injunctions that both deter future violations of law and reshape the conduct of the industry, none of which, of course, could possibly happen in arbitration. So while, and I don't want to go on and on, I want to let Andy respond, but I think it's hard to read this very comprehensive report and not come away with the impression that the Bureau will do some regulating and that the Bureau should do some regulating.
Thanks, Deepak, and it's great to participate in this, and thanks to the Federalist Society. And as he did in the Supreme Court, my colleague has presented a very persuasive argument, but let's unpack it a little bit, because I think once you probe beneath the surface, just like probing beneath the surface of the CFPB report, frankly, there's a lot less there than meets the eye. Let me start with process. Because I know that that's sort of lawyers love process, but to some extent, I think that's a disturbing indicator that this is a project that had a goal, which was to demonstrate that arbitration is bad and sort of single-mindedly pursued it. The Bureau started out on the right foot. It asked for information, for comments on how to conduct the study. A lot of interested parties submitted comments. A lot of those comments said, great idea, here are the areas you should study. Why don't you tell us what you're going to study and give us some time to submit information and then have a process of transparency like other government agencies that conduct study, and I'm thinking about agencies as diverse as the FCC, the FTC, and even the FSOC for all of its non-transparency. And then have an open meeting, a symposium, where you have people together and you have some discussion, either of preliminary results or of the comments that have been filed or of particular questions, in order to really illuminate what's going on here. The Bureau did none of that. In fact, after that initial request for information, it did no outreach whatsoever to the public. You could file comments if you wanted. You can meet with people if you wanted. But it was a one-way street. You could talk about what you wanted to talk about, but you got no visibility into what the Bureau was studying, what information would be useful, what, if it was studying A, maybe information about B would be illuminating to their examination of A. Absolutely nothing. There was an interim report issued that basically was released at one of the things the Bureau loves to do when it's going to make a decision is have, I would call it sort of a show trial. They call it a field hearing. There's a sort of a panel that looks balanced, some industry people and some consumer people and maybe some government people. They each get about 3 minutes to talk. The Bureau releases a very large document the night before to the press, and then the Bureau conducts its release and people get about 3 minutes, as I say, to respond to it. So a pretty disturbing process that led to this report. And it wasn't just interested members of the public that were shut out. Congress was shut out, too. Early on, there was a letter from senior members of the relevant House committees suggesting that more public input and more transparency was required, and the response that they got, and asking some specific questions about the study, and the response that they got back was basically to ignore most of the questions and answer one question about a contractor and one question about the number of FOIA requests they got, and that was about it. And then when the study was released, the Bureau's director said, although the study was supposed to just lay out the information, And then the Bureau was supposed to embark on the process of whether to issue a rule or not. The Bureau's director said, this study shows litigation is better for consumers than arbitration. So I guess we don't have much of a doubt in terms of the process on where this is going. So what about the study? As Deepak said, it lots of numbers in there. It's very empirical. I would call it the false objectivity of numbers. What the Bureau did was identify things that could be counted and count them. But there's no effort to sort of step back and say, gee, the ultimate inquiry here is what would be best for consumers? What information do we need to know? And what information, even though it's not specifically perhaps about arbitration in the consumer financial context, would be useful in illuminating whether this is good or bad for consumers? Instead, it is literally a number of discrete counting exercises that all of which, not surprisingly, add up to the preferred result. So let me talk about one of them. One was a public survey. People don't know that they have arbitration agreements in their credit card agreements. Of course, the Bureau didn't ask people whether they knew about any of the other provisions of their credit card agreements. Did they know what the interest rate was, what the penalty was for not filing on time? Did they know any of those things? Because the answer, speaking for myself, is likely to be no. Sure, maybe I knew it at the time I applied for the credit card, or at the time that I actually got the card to begin with, but that's many years ago for the most part, and I certainly don't keep that stuff in my head now. One of the things that the Bureau counted was how salient was dispute resolution, and here's a surprise. Not one consumer of the more than 1,000 that were surveyed volunteered dispute resolution as something that was relevant to their credit card selection. So no surprise, perhaps, that no one remembers it. It's not just that it's not important to consumers when they make the choice. That seems to be something useful, but as I say, totally ignored by the Bureau, which went on to say, oh, no, what's really important is they don't know what kind of dispute resolution clause they have. Of course they don't know. It's not salient to them. It's not a basis for making their purchasing decision. Then we have the counting of the arbitration proceedings that are actually filed. One of the – I call this the look at the tip of the iceberg and not under the water problem. One of the things about arbitration is the availability of arbitration means for claimants, consumers in this context, employees in other contexts, it's a lot easier to file claims. The process isn't the sort of opaque judicial process. Often the filing fees are paid for by the company. Certainly that's true for the AAA for small claims. And often it's very easy. You can file online. So if you're a company and you've adopted an arbitration process, you have to know there are going to be a lot of claims. And by the way, you'll have to pay a lot of the initial costs. So virtually every company that has an arbitration system has an aggressive pre-arbitration settlement process because they want to cut off claims before they get to the process stage where the company starts incurring these administrative costs. So the real question is, how many claims are settled in that pre-arbitration process that never get to arbitration? I know that for AT&T, one of the pieces of evidence in a companion case to Concepcion was that AT&T in this pre-settlement process provided billions of dollars of benefit to consumers in order to resolve things in advance of arbitration. Of course, if all the consumer has in court, no need to do that because the consumer, except for some very large claim or a claim that's classable, which I'll get to, has no alternative. So you don't really have to worry about that. So again, counting the benefits of arbitration, that's totally ignored. The other thing, of course, that's totally ignored is that arbitration has been the topic of a sustained attack by the plaintiff's bar for the last, certainly intensively, for the last 10 years. So not surprisingly, that most plaintiff's lawyers don't use arbitration and counsel their clients against it. What would have been interesting for the Bureau to do would have been to study an area where arbitration has developed. And one of the things that we would have brought to the attention of the CFPB if they had asked about this particular question is, for example, the Kaiser Health System in California, which uses arbitration to settle claims and for which there is a huge satisfaction rate for both customers, consumers, and for other participants in the system, including evaluation of that system by an independent board. So let's not look at arbitration in its stunted current form. Let's see what benefits it is providing to consumers outside of arbitration and what benefits it could provide if it was actually supported by the CFPB instead of the CFPB trying to strangle it. The other thing I want to talk about is class actions, because DPAC very carefully used the phrase eligible for relief, and the CFPB does that too. Because as most people who practice in the class action area know, there's a huge difference between the headline amount in a class action settlement, and by the way, of course, all the cases are settled virtually, and the amount that actually goes to consumers. If you look at the amount that actually goes to consumers, the Bureau's data was sort of startlingly consistent with the study that Mayor Brown did of a sample of class actions. First of all, the vast majority of class actions that are resolved with nothing going to class members, either because they're settled with benefits only going to the named plaintiff, or they're dismissed or terminated in some other way with no class benefits. So in the Bureau, only 12% of the class actions were studied, so not a very large volume. And then the question is, what do people get? So the Bureau reported a weighted average claims rate, which was of 4%. So in other words, 96% of class members get nothing in the claims. Why do claims weights matter? Because the headline of $2 billion shrinks dramatically when you're talking about the amount of money that people pick up. Now, the Bureau, again, perhaps showing where its head was at, studied the bank cases where there was automatic dispersal of class settlements. That's a very, very rare method of settlement. And people who are engaged in class actions know why, because in most cases, sad to say, but there is a little bit of a conspiracy between the plaintiff and the defendant in terms of how the class proceeds are divvied up in order to make the settlement acceptable to the defendant in terms of the total cost, but also acceptable to the plaintiff's lawyer in terms of the amount of money that is in the headline and that will provide the basis for the plaintiff's lawyer fee. So class actions, I think, are a very troubling and disturbing area. And while everyone has their favorite sort of anecdote, DPAC will have many anecdotes of great class actions that provided benefits. I will have many anecdotes of class actions that were essentially a joke and provided nothing. The fact is, when you study them in an empirical way, the vast majority are in the nothing category. And so the idea that we sacrifice the additional benefit that consumers get from being able to use arbitration to vindicate non-classable claims, and classable claims both, but non-classable small claims in particular, the sort of pie-in-the-sky benefit of class actions really provides no reason for taking that away from consumers. Deepak, well, back to you.
Yeah, thanks. So no surprise, Andy has a very well-argued case, very well-stated case. I think, you know, unlike in court where we know who has the burden of proof and sort of what the rules of the road are, here we're in a free-for-all policy debate, and it's not really clear who has the burden of proof and what the appropriate baseline is. I'll just start with the last set of remarks that Andy made. I'll start from there about class actions, because I do think whenever folks have a discussion about this issue, it tends to end up ultimately in a policy debate about the utility of the class action device, and that is kind of the gorilla in the room. That's ultimately, I think the CFPB's study is not shy about that, that's really the principal effect of the arbitration clause in a consumer financial services contract, and so it's not surprising that that's where the policy debate ends up. And I agree with Andy that, you know, there are bad class actions. There's no question about that. And there is collusion quite often between plaintiffs' lawyers and defendants. And there, just like with any powerful tool, the class action device can be abused. And I think the Bureau's study has no illusions about that either. And that's why, as I mentioned earlier, to try to account for the problem of claims rates, the Bureau also looks at cases where there's cash directly deposited in consumers' accounts, which, as it happens, is quite common when the defendant is a bank. And after all, the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau is a regulator of consumer banking accounts, so it makes particular sense to look at that. And when you do look at those cases, I mentioned the overdraft cases, you see that there are actually hundreds of millions of dollars in cash relief deposited directly to consumers in those cases. And those are cases where 100% of the consumers receive relief. And so, again, you've got to contrast that with what consumers receive in arbitration. And the statistics I gave earlier, I think, show that the answer is effectively nothing. And it is really no answer to point to the customer service process at a bank, because I think you can think of consumer claims as falling into kind of two buckets. You know, one bucket is a simple case where, you know, I ordered two widgets, you sent me one, I would like my two widgets, and it's a kind of a customer service dispute. The second bucket of claims are claims where the consumers are attacking systemic policies, where there are public norms at issue. And those are the cases where the consumer financial protection laws that are administered by the Bureau come into play and where class actions are effective. And customer service really doesn't address those claims. The whole reason we need a legal system and we need consumer protection law is that, you know, customer service is not a panacea. The market is not going to take care of it altogether. If it did, we would need no consumer protection law at all. And that, you know, obviously it's a larger debate. I think the CFPB should not be faulted for acting against the baseline that, look, there are these consumer laws, they're valuable, they should be enforced, and class actions exist. Congress created them. Andy and I, you know, would both agree that there are some class actions that deliver very important compensatory and deterrent effects. And so the Bureau, I think, would rightly draw the conclusion that, look, if they have these pretty significant compensatory and deterrent effects, and the upshot through consumer arbitration is that consumers are getting effectively nothing, then it's not a very hard calculus. And so let's look at, you know, I mentioned how much consumers got in small dollar cases, but if you look at the same data, the American Arbitration Association data from 2010 and 2011, the total amount of affirmative relief that consumers got was $172,000. That is, you know, essentially nothing when you compare that against the hundreds of millions of dollars, not just that consumers were eligible for in class action settlements, but that consumers actually received, particularly in cases without a claims process where the claims rate is irrelevant. Now, I want to now turn to the process attacks, because I think that's what Andy opened with, and we'll be hearing a lot of that on the assumption that the Bureau does write a rule, and then there's litigation about that rule. I think a lot of it will focus on process attacks. I think that's because the substance of the study is so overwhelming that it's natural that its opponents would focus on process. The reality is that this study has been in the works for 3 years. The Bureau, when it began the study, issued a request for information seeking public input on the scope, methods, and data sources for the work. The Bureau got dozens of comments in response, held a series of stakeholder meetings. I know Andy was at some of those meetings as a representative of his clients and the chamber. And then the Bureau issued preliminary results and then continued to get feedback from stakeholders. That the preliminary result was a progress report, and it was intended to facilitate a comment. And my impression of this whole study process is that there's been an enormous amount of comment and input that's been generated by it, more so than I think you see in most rulemakings. It's actually generated a lot of academic study. So Andy mentioned that Mayor Brown put out its own study. A lot of interested groups have put out various studies, and it's actually spurred academic research on this topic. I think we'll continue to see more of that. So I actually think it's been a very robust process, and there are going to be, as there always will be, there'll be some grounds for complaint. You didn't look at this, you didn't look at that. But if you look at what the Bureau did study, the comparison is so stark that it's hard to see how a court, given the Bureau's broad mandate, would have any basis for overturning a rule. And then just finally, two last points. Andy talked about consent and how it's not surprising that consumers don't know about arbitration clauses. And I think that's true. That's what I expected the study would show. I think it accords with our kind of common sense understanding that most people don't know about these things. But the difference here is, first of all, I mean, the Bureau was supposed to study arbitration clauses, not every possible kind of contract term. Congress wanted the Bureau to focus on these contract terms and to consider regulating them, so it's not surprising that they focused on those terms. And arbitration is founded on this fiction in the consumer context, it's often a fiction of consent, right? The idea of the Federal Arbitration Act is that two people get together, negotiate a contract because they want a dispute resolution process that's an exception from the norm, which is what the laws passed by Congress provide and the public court system. So I think the Bureau would be right to be concerned that such a momentous decision to exit the civil justice system and to exit legal accountability is being done through a fiction of consent where consumers are not even aware of it. And finally, Andy makes an interesting suggestion that I haven't really thought about much until now, that because the plaintiff's bar has attacked forced arbitration, that's the reason plaintiff's lawyers aren't using it. I think that, that deserves some further scrutiny, but it's hard for me to believe because you have a system that incentivizes any plaintiff's lawyer who wants to come forward and bring a claim, and if it was actually economically beneficial, if they could actually recover something for their clients and recover something for themselves, I think you'd see some market develop. And so I think the reason that we're not seeing that is because it doesn't make sense as an economic matter, not because all of the lawyers in the country are for ideological reasons foregoing otherwise valuable things. So I'll stop there.
A couple of things to say. I guess just picking up on the last point, I think the problem here is that arbitration will allow the merits of claims to be tested more easily. I mean, everybody knows, and all the studies, ours and the CFPB's and every study I know of, has shown that class actions in this context never get decided on the merits. So nobody really knows what the merits are. It's a game of, does your complaint have allegations that can survive a motion to dismiss, and can you get the class certified? If those two things happen, whether or not there was fraud or whether or not people were deceived or what the facts are, never get adjudicated by anyone. There's just a settlement. And I think one of the great benefits of arbitration is there will be adjudication of claims. And just to take an example, AT&T, the arbitration provision that was at issue in Concepcion, provides a special incentive for bringing small claims. If you bring a small claim, and AT&T, and you reject the settlement offer, and you get even a penny more in arbitration than the settlement, you get a minimum of $10,000, regardless of what your actual damages are. You get double attorney's fees. You get all of your costs paid. So if people have legitimate claims and they apply to thousands or in AT&T's case, millions of people who are AT&T users, you'd think that would be a bonanza for plaintiffs' lawyers. But in fact, the few times that it's been tried, the claims have gone to be heard on the merits, and they've been rejected. And so I think one of the reasons people shy away from the arbitration system is because it actually does get to the merits, and that's not a very happy place for those claims to be. Let me make a couple of other points. I mean, Deepak, I think, hit the nail on the head when he said the class action question is critical here, and class actions generally are used to provide systemic relief when appropriate. And whatever the merits of that might have been before the CFPB was created, one of the reasons the CFPB was created was because there was a belief that there was not enough systemic enforcement. So we now have an agency with a $660 million budget, a large chunk of which is being used for enforcement and for supervision examination, because it has supervision and examination authority. And so the question is, to my mind, given that huge enforcement resource that's been added, can there really be a serious claim that there are going to be gigantic systemic abuses that aren't going to be addressed by the regulator? That was one of the questions that was posed to the CFPB in those early comments, and the CFPB purported to look at it. But, of course, it looked at it by gerrymandering the period studied, so it was before the CFPB's enforcement and examination processes got up and running. So we really don't know whether there's any significant claims out there that are not being handled by the CFPB that couldn't be brought in arbitration and that outweigh the benefits of arbitration. I want to talk about the benefits for a minute, because Deepak has talked about sort of how many awards were there in arbitration, and of course there weren't that many for the reasons that I've talked about, but the few that there were resulted in greater amounts than the median and the average settlement amounts in court. So nobody can say when arbitration gets to the merits, it provides less relief or is somehow skewed against consumers. To the contrary, every study, not just this one, but in a variety of contexts, has found that consumers, employees, whoever the claimant is, does better in arbitration. And of course, even in arbitration, the vast majority of claims that are filed are settled before they get to the resolution stage, just like in court. If we said the judicial system's relief should be determined by how many judgments on the merits there are, it would be a really, really small number, and it wouldn't include any class actions. Let me do two things. Let me first of all say I think I'll be done in about 3 or 4 minutes, so if people have questions and they want to get them ready, and if we want to tell people how to do that, maybe I'll pause for a minute.
Yeah, that would be great. So in a moment, you will hear a prompt that will say the floor mode is on. And after that, to request the floor, enter star and then the pound key. So here it comes. Again, star and the pound key to ask a question. Go ahead.
Okay, while people are pressing their buttons or getting their questions ready, let me just address the process question for a minute. Deepak mentioned that there were outreach meetings that the Bureau held. Yes, there were. And let me give you an example of one that was held after the report was issued. There probably were 15 or so representatives from the business community in the room. We had about an hour and 15 minutes to talk about a 728-page report. Not a lot of time to give detailed feedback or really any kind of feedback at all. And just to underline the process issues, I think this is a great contrast. I mentioned, and Deepak mentioned, the survey that the Bureau conducted about knowledge of underlying agreements. Because the Paperwork Reduction Act separately requires a notice and comment procedure with respect to such surveys, the Bureau conducted two notice and comment processes on the survey instrument and the survey process. One, then it was revised, another set of comments. In other words, there was more outreach with respect to the survey, not a very relevant part of the study, but certainly a very small percentage of it, because it was actually required by law, then the Bureau felt appropriate to provide with respect to the vast rest of the survey, which was addressing the relevant issues. Last point about this consent question. I think we all learned in contracts that consent is the foundation of contracts. It's not the foundation, except in a fictional sense, of form contracts. I don't have any choice about any of the terms for almost every contract I enter into every day, whether it's with my internet and TV and telephone provider, my mobile provider, my websites that I participate in. The list goes on and on. It's all form contracts, and those contracts are supervised by the courts through unconscionability regimes, just like arbitration clauses are. I mean, one of the reasons that I think the 2006 experience in arbitration and today are quite different is the Supreme Court and the lower courts have made clear that although the FAA imposes some limits on what the states can require about arbitration provisions, there is, as long as they're applying generally applicable unfairness provisions, principles rather, arbitration provisions that, for example, say, oh yeah, the general counsel of the company picks the arbitrators, or you can have arbitration, but the fee is $5,000, even though the claim is going to be $100, or you can have arbitration, but you have to go to Alaska for the in person for the arbitration. Those are routinely struck down, as are any attempts to limit the availability of consequential damages or punitive damages or attorney's fees. So there's a lot more judicial supervision than there used to be, and that supervision is a consequence of the fact that we live in a world of form contracts, for better or worse. Do we have any questions?
We don't have any questions yet. So again, if you'd like to ask a question of either of our experts to get their take on it, press star and then the pound key. I don't know if Mr. Gupta's got any thoughts in response or.
Yeah, I have a lot of thoughts in response. I'm not sure I'll be able to address all of what Andy said, and I certainly don't want to get in the way of anyone on the call who has any questions. So if you've got
go ahead, and if we do get a question that pops on, I'll let you know. But feel free. We've got about 10 minutes left, so feel free to. Take some time to respond.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, this has been a very interesting discussion. I think, you know, Andy and I do agree that when it comes to form contracts, consent has largely become a fiction. I think that's right, and that's a kind of a reality of the modern world. But, you know, it's not something that we should regard as necessarily a good thing. And I think it does upset and force us to reconsider how some of the basic assumptions of contract law operate in this new reality. Andy mentions the kind of regulatory impact that unconscionability doctrine has, and you know, I think that is has been historically an important check on the worst kinds of abuses that would be possible through arbitration clauses. But you know, one reason we're here, and one reason the CFPB has put out this report is what the Supreme Court has done. Up until the Concepcion case that Andy and I argued, the lower courts had been striking down these arbitration clauses with class action bans using generally applicable contract principles, the unconscionability doctrine. And so that prevented arbitration from being used sort of cynically as a way of thwarting people from banding together and bringing claims without even knowing that they had foregone that opportunity. That is no longer available because of the Concepcion decision, which preempts all of that law that had been developed. And so I think one way of reading what the Bureau may be about to do is a reversal of the Supreme Court's very controversial 5-4 decision within the context of the consumer financial services marketplace. And I think that would be an appropriate response. So, you know, I think it's interesting that the focus of the Bureau's report is actually on the one area that the Supreme Court has completely withdrawn from unconscionability, and I think that's not surprising. Do we have questions?
Any further thoughts?
Well, I think I think that's a pretty good summary of the debate. I mean, we obviously have a lot that we disagree on, but I do think it's interesting that so much of the attack on what the Bureau has done here is really on the process rather than on the substance. And I think some of the numbers are just very, very difficult to argue with. And so I like where the debate stands. I'm very happy with what the Bureau has done with its authority. I think it's remarkable given the constraints on federal agencies and the limited resources that they've put out the work that they have. And I think, right now there's an appropriations rider that has emerged from the House Appropriations Committee that would really make the Bureau's work very, very difficult, kind of try to kill the study and the rulemaking through 1,000 cuts. It'd be interesting to see what happens with that in the appropriations process. My sense is it's not going to survive the Senate and won't emerge from Congress. And I think the administration would probably prevent a measure like that from emerging. But it'll be interesting, and it's part of a broader debate about the role of the CFPB and financial reform generally.
Just to sort of make two quick points. First of all, the focus of the appropriations rider is really to correct the process problems, including the agency's failure to take on board Congress's prior suggestions about what an appropriate process should be. But I wouldn't want to leave anyone with the view that this is solely about process. We've put together 20 pages of critique of the Bureau's analysis in a whole variety of areas. Its class action analysis, which, if you follow it through, says the average amount actually received by someone through a class action, all the class actions studied by the Bureau, is $30.38. So again, is this process, it's all a cost-benefit question. And the question is that benefit worth the cost in terms of the system as a whole, and taking away something that, although it's not completely true yet in the consumer context, in a myriad of other contexts, employment, healthcare, as I mentioned, has been a terrific mechanism for people to vindicate claims that aren't classable, which, as we all know as lawyers, is the vast majority of claims.
Well, on behalf of the Federal Society, I want to thank both of our speakers for a very great discussion. For those of you who joined the call late, as a reminder, this call, as well as all of our previous telephone conference calls, will be posted on our website as a podcast within 24 to 48 hours. So if you'd like to listen to the discussion again or catch any part that you missed at fedsoc.org, you can always find that. Be sure to check our website as it is updated frequently with new conference calls that are added every week. So until next time, we're adjourned, and thank you all very much for calling in.
Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.